My turn.
So, over here on the table, we have some ancient hardware made in Switzerland by a company called Nagra and a man, Stefan Kudelski. And I invite you to come up here and look at it, because this is what location recording used to be. And this machine will run on D batteries, and it's pretty heavy. Your shoulder gets acclimated to it, and it will work anywhere from, you know, on a ship to the top of Mount Everest. They kind of set the bar for what location recorders were and had to be overcome. And John's company, Sound Devices, overcame that. So John is the co-founder of Sound Devices, founded in 1998, which, if you do the math, makes them 21, legal now. She was the managing director for the company's first 15 years, developed and managed sales, marketing, finance, tech support, and brand strategy. I think that says he was it. He's a regular lecturer and industry expert on audio and video production tools and technology, member of AES, SBE, and NAB. And if you don't know what the alphabet soup is, you have to ask me at break. 1989 grad of Northwestern School of Communications in radio, TV, and film. His first job was at Shure in tech support, answering their 800 number. He went on to become manager of their mixer and sound signal processor group. As a young boy, he was introduced to motion picture shooting and editing by helping his father, who was a physician, hot splice 16-millimeter films of experimental open-heart surgery. He lives in Madison, Wisconsin, with his wife and three kids. In his spare time, he does audio, funny thing. Family, road cycling, and photography. I give you John Tools.
Thank you. I think I have a laugh, so I'm good without the stick mic. I'm John Tools, and I would like to be a student at DigiPen. Now, this is quite a wonderful facility here, and thank you for being the host, and thank you to the Seattle AES. This is really a lovely environment here, and it's great to hear a little bit about each of you. And before we begin, there were some production sound mixers. So raise your hand if you are a production sound mixer, and that's kind of your core. So we got a few. So some of the stuff that I'm going to be covering hopefully will be review, but actually you might get something out of it. So let's get to the presentation here. So I've spent a lot of time in production sound, and Sound Devices equipment gets used in that context. And when I define production sound, what I'm really talking about is sound for picture. So let's turn the power on. I'm John Tatoulis from Sound Devices. So take one. 50% of a sound of a movie is sound. That comes from somebody who's a visual-oriented filmmaker, George Lucas. 80% of a movie is sound. That comes from a more narrative-oriented filmmaker. I never really know what I have until I get to the dub stage and I hear the mix. That was from Steven Spielberg when he gave a talk at the Cinema Audio Society back in February. This is probably the most salient for production sound mixers, and that is, with sound, no news is good news. I never get told sound is good. I only get contacted if there's a problem. Raise your hand if you can relate to that. That was a production sound mixer on Facebook. So when we talk about production sound, you know, there's any narrative or, you know, whether it's, you know, it has numerous stems. We've got the music stem, sound effect stems, Foley stems, voiceover, narration stems, and then production dialogue. And historically, you know, back in, you know, before 1927, the music was the accompanying piece. That was the soundtrack. You went to a movie theater, there was a live performance while you were watching the cinema. And in 1927, Warner Brothers decided, you know what, that orchestra is very expensive. So let's have pre-recorded music. And so that was the impetus to have sound accompanying picture. And then they realized, you know, we can have some dialogue sprinkled in. And by 1929, movies incorporated a tremendous amount of dialogue. So after 1929, 90% of movies had production dialogue. And so these are the stems. These are all the elements of sound. And the world that I spend a lot of time in is in sound effects recording, a little bit of music recording, but mainly dialogue. So that's going to be the area that we're going to talk a little bit about. So production dialogue, you know, in many narratives, that's what's carrying the emotion, the story. And we want to get it during production. Of all those recordings, of all those stems, the dialogue is the one performance that is matched with picture. So it's actually a little bit different of a context than some of the recording, of a music recording or a Foley performance, which you can do over and over again after the narrative is shot. So, but production dialogue, that's going to be captured at the same time that the image is captured. Now, sometimes you can't capture it when you're on set. The other day I was at CineSpace in Chicago. There's a TV show called Chicago Fire. There's Chicago PD, there's Chicago Med, Chicago Fire. Raise your hand if you've ever seen Chicago Fire. So it's a show on NBC, and they were on the fire set that day. And Blair Scheller, who's the production mixer, he was recording this production, and all you could hear was so that day, all he was recording was a guide track. So everything had to be replaced. But today, there are many directors. You know, if you're working with Quentin Tarantino, there is no dialogue replacement. Everything is production. Everything is done at production. And fortunately, we have the tools, we have the technology to be able to do that. So our instruments are sensitive enough so we can do that. ADR is automatic dialogue replacement, or dialogue replacement. So this is somebody who's doing the performance after the narrative is shot. They will go back onto a stage. Sometimes the stage is dedicated for that. Sometimes it's just around the corner, and you're going to do ADR right after the scene. Some actors put it in their contracts that I am not going to do ADR. So it all depends. But fortunately, you know, we have the tools and technology to get production sound at, you know, we can get dialogue during production. So when we talk about speech versus music and sound effects, these are two different worlds. Think about music. With music and sound effects, we can record with creative liberty that we don't necessarily have that luxury with dialogue. So we can record a guitar, we can put a microphone at the 12th fret, we can record the fingerboard, we can get the body sound, we can get a microphone over the shoulder, we can record snare drums with a microphone on top, we can have a reverse polarity microphone getting the snares on the bottom. We have so many tools that we can use. We don't necessarily have that luxury with speech, because unlike music, where it may be the very first time you're ever hearing that performance, with speech, everybody knows the sound of a human voice, and everybody has an expectation of what human speech is supposed to sound like. And they expect intelligible dialogue. So they expect it to sound a certain way. And that's the challenge of doing that while we're also shooting picture. And there's our wanted signals, and then there's our unwanted signals. We'll call our unwanted signals noise. So we have unwanted environmental noise, whether it's the HVAC that you can hear right now, whether it's broadband or frequency specific, it might be highway noise, it might be a variety of tools, a variety of things. If it's frequency specific, well, some of our post folks have some phenomenal tools to get in there and to be able to remove some of that. But if it's broadband, maybe not. Reverberation. If we're in a reverberant space and we're beyond critical distance, anybody know what critical distance is? A few of you. Critical distance is a place in a physical space where the direct sound energy equals the reverberant sound energy. And if you're beyond critical distance and you have a microphone beyond critical distance, it doesn't matter where that microphone is because you're not getting any additional direct sound. So that's additional noise. Electrical system noise, whether it's microphone noise, self noise in preamplifiers and things like that. Fortunately today, every successive generation of gear we have gets quieter and quieter, so that becomes less of a noise source, but it's certainly something to consider. And as we know, variations in noise floor, as it modulates, is more apparent, and we perceive that as humans more than steady-state noise. Great example, the sound mixer Mark Ulano, who does, the Hateful Eight. So he did Hateful Eight. They're in Colorado in a stagecoach in minus 28 degrees. They're on location, and they're recording dialogue when they're in the stagecoach. They need to match that sound when they're on a refrigerated stage back in Hollywood. So simultaneously with recording the dialogue while they're on location, he's also recording a 5-1 surround mix, so that a surround recording, so that they can use that as their constant background. So you want to oftentimes record background sound. It's funny. Anybody record room tone? All right, so a lot of room tone. Oftentimes, these days, room tone might be a quarter second, half second. They'll just loop it. Room tone's different for a lot of people. Now, there are some room tone. Instead of doing room tone, let's do an impulse response of the space. So now we can reproduce that space. So there's different ways to accomplish getting that consistent background sound. But back to our signal to noise, our wanted signal to unwanted signal. You know, with speech, if you have an environment where you've got speech that's greater than 15 dB above the noise sources, that's a tremendous thing, and you want that. That's certainly ideal. But the thing about speech, our human auditory system is designed so that we can actually perceive speech in negative signal-to-noise environments. If you're ever in a restaurant and you see somebody across, a loud space, incredibly reverberant, you can still hear them. It's incredibly fatiguing, and you also have additional cues. You might have visual cues. You might have binaural cues. So these are other things that you may have that are able to give you intelligible speech. And think about this. We talked about stems. Every time we add a stem, we're increasing the noise floor, and we're decreasing intelligibility. So all of us have heard great movie mixes where we can hear the dialogue and all that. But all of us have also heard mixes where the wall is way up, and Foley art is way up, and the music is hot, and dialogue is incredibly difficult to hear. Sometimes that's the stylistic interpretation of when they were mixing the show, and that's how they wanted it to be. Sometimes it just was a consequence of a big action picture, and that's just they wanted to make and present all those elements. So remember that when you're producing, that when you add those other elements, you're reducing the intelligibility of speech. So microphones are our tools, and these are the most important tools in a sound mixer's arsenal. And there's a reason I started my career at a microphone manufacturer. I started at the start, and then I worked to a mixer manufacturer. I started from the beginning in my career at the beginning of the signal chain, the microphone, and I'm continuing down here. Pretty soon I'll be working at a loudspeaker manufacturer as you are developing loudspeakers. So microphones are, at their core, fairly simple tools. They convert sound pressure changes to electric signals. So that's all these things do. They have these incredibly thin membranes. They're very sensitive to pressure changes, and they're converting that to an electrical signal. Microphones don't do a lot more than they do. They don't listen. So a microphone is a measurement tool. Humans listen. Microphones measure. Microphones also don't zoom. Now, theoretically, you could build a zoom microphone We once had Yuri Shulman, who worked at Shure, was one of their electroacoustic guys and developed numerous microphones. He calculated what it would take to make a Zoom microphone. Now think about the wavelength of light. Pretty small. Think about the wavelength of sound. It's pretty big. So you could theoretically make a Zoom microphone. It would be absolutely enormous, and it's not feasible. Now the thing that is pretty remarkable these days is there are, you know, we have very powerful signal processing. We have, you know, that can do math very fast. So now we can take multiple microphones and effectively make much bigger microphones. So with arrayed microphones, we can change the polar patterns and we can do some very unique things. But they still don't zoom. They also don't discriminate between what we want to record and what we don't want to record. Placement does. Good choice of microphone selection. Those are the things that do. And also, you know, our brain is the best signal processor. I mean, it is an incredibly powerful signal processor. Again, we're just turning electrical, we're turning pressure into electrical signals. So you've all been in headphones. You all know what it sounds like to be in a room, but just bear with me for a quick moment. I want you to take away your visual cues, and I want you to take away your binaural cues. So close your eyes and seal off one of your ears as tightly as you can. And now hear what this room sounds like. And now you hear me. You hear, it's much more reverberant. Wow. Now I hear the HVAC. Now I hear all these other elements. I'm hearing people in the hallway. So that, when we're in cans, this is what we hear. That's what the microphone is picking up. The microphone's not hearing. It's just presenting those signals to us. So we've got to be the sound mixer to use these tools and deploy them correctly so we can get exactly what we want. So what do we do to get good dialogue recording? It truly starts with the performance. There are some notorious mumblers in cinema and in Hollywood, and that's a challenge right there. So, but it starts with a great performance and in a great controlled location. Sometimes the location's going to dictate, well, you know, I'm next to, I have this phenomenal view of the city, yet below me is a highway. Well, there's going to be a decision there whether the picture is what we want or whether the sound is what we want. And oftentimes, those two don't meet. Best microphone selection and placement. So, you know, this is not the time and place to talk about all the different polar patterns and microphone selection and microphone tools, but knowing that and being able to deploy them correctly, that's essential, you know? And the two main tools, minimizing subject to microphone distance, that's the one very powerful tool we have in our arsenal. Bringing the microphone closer to the subject, more direct sound, less indirect sound. And then maximizing and using the off-axis response of our microphones. So if I'm indoors and I'm shooting using a shotgun microphone, that might not be the best choice because that microphone has a fair bit of sensitivity behind it. You know, so I'm not going to want to use that really directional microphone indoors. I might want to use more of a hypercarnegie mic. But knowing that, all right, I've got the generator outside over there, well, let's see if we can orient the action so that the generator's off axis. The generator comes up a lot when you're talking to sound mixers who go on location. That's a case where, any of you familiar with a CEDR, the real-time noise reduction tool? Yeah, I've used CEDRs specifically in that application where I had no choice. The generator was going to be there whether we wanted to or not. This is something that, you know, one microphone per sound source. If you're a microphone manufacturer, you don't want to hear me say use the fewest number of microphones as possible. But that's the case. There's a reason why that Nagra and a single boom was the gold standard for sound. One microphone, multiple sound sources. So it follows my rule here, one microphone per sound source. We don't want that case where, like we're recording a drum, we don't want to have multiple microphones on a single sound, especially speech, because I have this beautiful, expensive microphone that I just bought that has this great linear frequency response. If I take another microphone and I bring that microphone up and also record that same signal and I sum those together, what happens to that beautiful frequency response? I now get comb filtering. It's going to start to be not the same frequency response as my original. So we want to minimize that one microphone per sound source. Hire an experienced sound mixer. This is something that experience is critical. And you know, the only way you gain that is by doing. So this is, you know, speaking to the students here. You know, oftentimes you might have a project where it may be, you know, you have no option. This has to be nailed. Bring somebody in who really knows what they're doing and watch what they're doing. That's the best way to learn. So, you know, this is a microphone. Oftentimes when a camera is placed somewhere, most of the time the camera's placed where the camera should be placed, not where the microphone is placed. So that's a great example of microphone placement. Right now I'm using a wireless system. And wireless is, I really call it a miracle, because this microphone's picking my signal up. It's right underneath my sweater here. It's going into the transmitter. Then a miracle happens. It shows up at the receiver. We don't really need to talk exactly how that miracle happens. It's pretty cool. And then that signal goes into our PA, into our recording chain. So wireless is a wonderful tool, and it's a wonderful tool because it replaces a perfectly good $20 microphone cable with an incredibly complex, expensive system that adds another gain stage, especially if it's an analog. Now, here's the thing. We own a wireless microphone manufacturer, so just letting you know. We bought a company called Audio Limited a few years ago, which is a very well-regarded wireless manufacturer. And they make a superb product, a great digital link. And so the reality is that it's absolutely required for contemporary production. So it's not feasible to be using hard lines, especially when there's 16 actors running around on a stage, and you know, we need to record all of them. That you simply are not going to be doing that with a hard line. In some jurisdictions, I don't know if it's in Seattle, but if you're outdoors and you can't have a cable between two people. So, for instance, if you're in downtown LA, you can't have a physical cable plugged into a camera if you're the sound mixer. That's against fire code. It's just simply required. And modern wireless performance, it's remarkable when using the right tools, the right frequency selection, the right antennas, the right, you know, frequency coordination, all that, wireless performance is superb. We can use tons and tons of wireless. I mean, you go to the biggest shows, and when done right, wireless works remarkably well. And digital wireless in particular is something that we're starting to see now more and more. So for instance, Audio Limited came out with a digital wireless, their A10 digital. So essentially, everything from the analog signal from the microphone is still an analog electrical signal, but it goes into the body pack, gets converted to a digital signal, and from then on, from this digital signal here, all the way until you are sitting watching the program, that signal remains digital. It's digital in the recording, it's digital in the post, it's digital in mixdown, it's digital in the deliverable. I mean, until it hits a D to A in your earbuds, in your, you know, stereo receiver at home or your television, you know, that signal's going to remain digital. So that's where wireless is moving very quickly today. But back to what we really want, this is a very simple setup here. We've got the talent, we've got a boom microphone just outside of frame. That's, you know, when somebody says, where do I put the boom microphone? Well, just outside of frame, as close as you can, minimizing that subject to microphone distance. It's a hard line microphone, so we're not using wireless here. No reason to, we're a sit down. I did a project in, I was in the Roosevelt Room in the White House, and I was doing a live stream, and I was mixing this show for Google. And unfortunately, I did not specify the kit. So they brought in the kit, and here we are after going through all the security. We did not have a hard line. There was no... So this was with POTUS at the time. This was with Obama. And so we mic up Obama, and he's on a wireless, and we're in a small room that's, you know, and he's about from where Charlie is to me on a wireless system. And as soon as he walks in, we had a primary and a backup. We started getting hits because the Secret Service comes in and they've got their business, their jammers and all that stuff. And it was a nightmare. Fortunately, I was able to hang on just a little, you know, long enough with another frequency that worked well. But when you can, hard line. I took this photo the other day. This is Madison. So this is a great example of local television. So she's not only the reporter, she's also the camera operator, and she's, anybody know what that microphone is? Like it's an RE50. So that's a great example of subject to microphone distance that's a little kind of too far. Very reverberant space, that's probably not going to sound so good. And one rule that I like to have when you ever go on set and you see something is you oftentimes see camera operators looking through their monitors or looking through their viewfinders. It's the same thing with production sound. If there's nobody wearing headphones on set, you can guarantee that something's going to get missed. You're going to guarantee that you're going to miss some line noise or whatever it might be, even if you've got the perfect scenario. Somebody's got to be monitoring in headphones. So if she's not monitoring in headphones, my guess is the audio's not going to be so good. I've got a few pictures of some sound setups here. This is you know, kind of the classic one-man band. This is Matt Mayer. That's a 633 in his bag. He's doing a booming application here. So this is, you know, kind of the common over-the-shoulder, you know, kind of production. This setup is a Dante setup. So raise your hand if you're familiar with Dante. Okay, so a fair number. For those of you that are not familiar, that is audio over IP. So his console, it's an O1V, he's connected to that recorder that's right there. That's a 970 over Dante. So he can, with a single Cat 5 cable, in fact, I'll explain this setup here in a minute. You know, Dante allows you to run audio over an IT infrastructure. It's quite a powerful tool. That's Blair from Chicago Fire. He's using an analog desk at the front end of his recording. So a lot of mixers have the comfort factor of using an analog desk. And that's a perfectly valid way to approach things. The penalty is weight and size. You know, that's an audio developments console. I'm not sure which model. It's a beast. You know, it's about 30 pounds. So that cart, you know, is quite a big cart. You know, there's less I/O in that cart than there is in this product right here. You know, so things are definitely simplifying and getting smaller, but you know, analog is still what sound is. So it's still a very relevant thing. This is a fun cart. This is George Flores on a set of Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Very fun show. So George, it's got a 664 electro venue-ish thing there. He's in Patty's Pub, and that is a baby cart. So he was using a baby cart because it's very easy to get through doorways. He can wheel it in. He can take it to the beach. And, you know, if it gets destroyed, he just goes to Costco and buys another one. It's actually quite a clever way to approach a project. A little mini cart. This is a big reality show, you know, big Yamaha console and a Riedel intercom. And, you know, so there's many worlds of production sound, from simple one person to competition reality where there's four locations of action and everybody's wired and you've got, you know, 32, 64 inputs. It gets quite quite involved. That's a Yamaha LS into a 970. So, you know, that classic Hollywood cinema where, you know, you had the Mitchell film camera and you had the big Fisher boom and all that. Well, you know, those days are over because now we're into multi-camera production. Everything you see on television, you know, especially, you know, all the Netflix shows, you know, they're shot with three Alexas. So it's a standard production method because it accelerates things so much. So using multiple cameras at the same time speeds up drama production. And the reason is you can do what's called a simultaneous wide and tight. So you know what the establishing wide shot is, and you know the close-ups. Now, with multiple cameras, you shoot them all at the same time. That way you can do the reverse angle, you can do the establishing shot. And the challenge with that is you can't get the boom in. So the boom operator, they're going to be in the scene. Some shows, they still use the boom because they have a big enough budget that they can actually paint the boom out in post. You know, shows like House of Cards, they on some of the scenes, they use the boom. They painted the boom out in post. That's a pretty big budget. You know, I'm sure there's students here learning how to do that kind of stuff. But it's the reality is that you now are putting lavs on everybody. So even if you are booming, you're gonna put a lav, you're gonna put a wireless on everybody who's got a talking part. So what that means is two things. One is your track count goes up. So you've got more inputs. And these days, post is going to want all of those lavs as individual ISO tracks. Just, I want an ISO track. You know, Game of Thrones, Ronan Hill, the production mixer, he uses a 788. As the season progressed, he used another 788. So he's got two 788s linked, and he kept calling me, you know, every 6 months, John, do you have anything more than two 788s linked? I said, well, you could always go three 788s. So that gets absurd because now you've got multiple devices and you got to manage the files. Finally, Game of Thrones had their fifth season. The show is over. We introduced the product for Ronin. So we now have a tool that has enough I.O. that can cover those big monster ensemble cast kind of shows. You know, this product here, this is our Scorpio. This was released in April. That has 16 microphone inputs, 32 channels, so you can come in over Dante or with the SL6, which is the wireless adapter. So it's a very powerful tool for very channel, track-heavy kinds of applications. You know, the other consequence of modern production is we roll and roll and roll and roll. And if you're doing reality shows, you start at the beginning of the day, you hit record, you're recording 16, 32 channels all day long. At the end of the day, you hit stop. And some poor production assistant has to go through all of that material and log it. It's a tremendous amount of information. So, and even in drama and, you know, feature, we're rolling. We're shooting more than we ever have. You know, multi-track. We're doing more multi-track than we ever have. You know, multi-track used to be more than one track. You know, this is a mono recorder. This was the gold standard for many, many years.
Two channels.
This one's two. That's a four. Which one is this?
4S.
Oh, it's a 4S. Okay. So this is multi-track. Yeah. See, mine's a 4.2, it's only mono. So, but you know, we introduced our first production recorder, the 744T, in 2004, and that was essentially a digital audio tape replacement. So we moved from DAT, so first from analog tape to digital tape. Digital tape didn't last very long in the production world because it was just so unreliable. I would take a Naga recorder any day over a DAT machine. One of the reasons is, you know, DAT's a is a helical head. And if the playback machine, the material that's playing back, wasn't exactly aligned correctly in the same way as the recording machine, it's not going to play back correctly. So oftentimes, you had to play back and lay off the material from the original machine that it was recorded on for DAB. And that was a challenge. They did not handle environment. You know, Nagra, you know, as Rick said, this thing could be used anywhere. You know, and DAT was not capable of doing that. So we saw a transition from analog tape to file, to digital file. And the first file-based production recorder was the Zaxcom Diva that showed up in 97, I think in December of 97. And, you know, that was two channels or four channels. And then we came out in 2004, very similar to when the ported drive came out. And the original Kantar was a year after that. And then in 2008, we came out with the 8-channel 788T. And then a few years after that, we came out with the 970, which is a 64-channel production recorder that records from Dante sources or MADI, AES, or analog. So that you oftentimes see that on a big production card. But multitrack is because everybody's speaking part, you know, is required to record an isotrack. That's just what is required. And now it's one microphone per sound source. So we're not using one microphone, and as people are talking, we're moving that microphone around. Now we just have that one microphone for that sound source. That's just the way modern production is doing. And the mix is less relevant for many types of shows. So if you're, you know, episodic television, all the Netflix stuff, I mean, the requirement is, oftentimes there's no requirement for a mix. They just want the ISOs. So they're just gonna take ISOs and mix them in post. I still think it's important to deliver a mix because, you know, for a dailies process, you still wanna have a good mix. But you know, for some projects, it's less important. For other projects, that mix is really important, and that's where other tools show up, like automatic mixing. Anybody here ever use an automatic mixer? Raise your hand if you know what Dugan automixing is. Okay. All right. So many of you know what Dugan is. Some of you may not have used it, but automatic mixing has been popular for sound reinforcement for years. You know, I think Dugan's original speech patent was in 1974. So it gives you an idea how long this idea has been around. You know, we've implemented automatic mixing in our production mixers. And it was somewhat of a unique, novel thing at first, but we recognize that there's a lot of people that are doing live stream productions or other applications where they're delivering a mix, and automatic mixing is a tremendous advantage, especially for unscripted dialogue, competition reality, where there's many centers of action. When you have multiple microphones and you have multiple talkers, every time you double the number of microphones, how much does that raise the gain? Anybody? For an uncorrelated signal, I take two signals, uncorrelated, 3 dB. So every time I double, I've got 3 dB. So if I'm opening up microphones all the time and closing them, and I have to manage all that, that's what an automatic mixer does. It's going to attenuate unused microphones. It's going to do that automatically. You still have to set levels. You still have to mix. But it's going to automatically turn microphones on and off. And Dugan automixing is the gold standard for, you know, smooth automatic mixing. And you hear it on many shows. It's built into all big Yamaha consoles, and you know, for a lot of you know, stand-up kind of applications, sound reinforcement applications, Dugan is almost always used. You know, live streams, panel discussions, things like that. You know, our mixers get used in that application. So, you know, Dugan is a powerful tool for that. You know, as I mentioned before, real-time noise reduction is also something that we sometimes see. I've been, I've mixed a show where, again, I had a generator outside. It was, you know, the windows were from a 1920 building, so they're really thin. It's coming in. You have no choice. You know, Cedar was a tool that just dialing in, you know, 3-5 dB of Cedar, which, you know, 5-6 dB starting to get pretty aggressive with it, but it was necessary to maintain good speech intelligibility. So, you know, some of these signal processing tools, you're going to start to see more and more of that on your production recorders. You know, this is a, you know, all analog tool. This will never be anything more than what it is here. A product like, you know, a modern production mixer is an application-specific computer. This has 3 very powerful FPGA processors. It can do a lot of math, and there's a lot of software that goes on in here. And so, you know, what we see over time is that these kinds of tools, we're going to have more powerful processing available for us. So products and tools at our disposal as we go forward. Double system sound is the world that we're talking about here, and that is, you know, a separate recorder, separate camera. And back in 2004 when we first introduced the 744T, I had a prediction that double system would go away, that we would no longer need double system, especially as cameras got more capable and they would just have some kind of digital input and, you know, productions would just record right to camera. I was so totally wrong, because what ended up happening was the explosion of track counts. And, you know, cameras still just need to be cameras. And, you know, the camera department and the sound department, they don't want to be near each other. So the tool we have is we're going to synchronize the elements between the two, and we use, you know, either a slate. Things are still slated. Time code. That's the gold standard of synchronization. Or modern-day tools like waveform matching. So you can, if a camera has a recording capability, use it. And then you can always match back and take your multi-track recording and sync that with, you know, tools like Pluralize or other tools that are built into the digital audio workstations.
How do you distribute time code, wired or wireless?
Well, time code is a fairly simple thing. All it is a high-precision clock that's measured at a specific rate. So if I have this device set to the same sampling rate and frame rate, this has a precision clock, and this one has a precision clock. And what I do is I do what's called a jam sync between the two. So I will apply the time value of one device to the time value to the other. You know, in typical production, sound is always master. So sound is distributing that time code value. In some cases, yes, they do a hard line. You can certainly do a continuous hard line, or you can send SMPTE time code, which is an audible signal. It's a square wave signal. If you ever listen to SMPTE, it's, you know, kind of sounds like buzz. But it's an audible signal. And you can transmit that over wireless. But with today's, you know, temperature compensated crystals, you know, we can jam sync and we can maintain good frame synchronization pretty much for a full day.
Oh, okay.
Now, time code is only frame accurate because SMPTE time code is in frames. So the specification for time code is either 2398, 24, 25, 29, 29, or 2997, 30, 2997, drop, 30, drop. That's it. The maximum precision is going to be 30 frames. Now, that's not good enough if I'm doing a music production and I've got multiple recorders together. At that point, I need to be word clocked together so my devices are running absolutely simultaneously. You can kind of get away. We've introduced a new tool on the Scorpio and the A33 where it will derive word clock from time code. It's a pretty cool tool, but still, it's not going to be sample accurate from device to device, but it will derive word, and devices that are locked together will run at the same rate. Because a lot of, you know, we now have the capability, because we're recording digital, to just record and record and record and record. You know, modern productions, you know, are shooting at, you know, 50-to-1. Some of these competition realities are, you know, up to 80-to-1 production ratios. You know, what does that mean? For every 50 minutes, 1 minute is the final product. Okay? It used to be, you know, when you shot a feature, it'd be like 4-to-1, you know, if they were lucky. You know, film was, you know, very scarce, very expensive. You know, think about what it took to shoot film and then, you know, get a work print and, you know, all that. So, you know, today we've got gigs and gigs of data, and hard drive manufacturers and solid state drive manufacturers are happy to give you bigger size drives. So we've got these enormous machines that we're now recording, you know, up to 36 tracks here. It's a lot of material. So metadata is a tool, that text-based tool that simplifies the management of these assets. So this is becoming more and more important. So as we generate a lot of stuff, you know, if you're doing, you know, a 13 episodes of a particular, you know, of a 50-minute Netflix show, you're generating a ton of files, ton of clips. And, you know, if you're doing the competition reality, there's just an incredible amount of files. So this is the not recorded material. This is all this text information that we can add. So we can add scene, take, a reel ID, which is kind of a throwback to the film reel. We're still calling it reel ID or roll. Like all these things we're still calling, you know, these physical constructs. It's kind of fun. But time code, frame rate, user bits, sampling rate, that all gets embedded in the file. So every time you hit record, it's recording that, as well as track names, file notes. There's also a unique file identifier. So every time you hit record, all this stuff is visible if you have a tool that can present this. And you're going to generate a sound report that incorporates all this information. So metadata becomes more and more important as the number of tracks you have goes up. And then manufacturers can extend it even more. They can add other fields. There's this specification we all use called IXML, which we can add more text into this. And, you know, this is a very important thing. It's not, if you're doing a day shoot, if you're just going and doing a, you know, small commercial or a small production and it's just a day, you probably don't need extensive metadata management. But if you've got a team and you're not the person who's doing post on the material that you recorded, metadata may be a way for you to communicate that to the next person.
Is this only with the RIP-WAV file format, or what about FLAC?
I'm not certain how well FLAC supports additional information. My guess is it probably could. I know an AAC file can support some of this. MP3 files can support it. We will be adding AAC as one of the compressed file formats. It's just a better sounding codec than MP3.
Yeah.
Our 633 and 688 record MP3 with timecode embedded. And where that gets sometimes used is if you're doing a news magazine, if you're doing you know, Hard Knocks for ESPN or Dateline or something like that. You can oftentimes, you'll send those MP3 files with timecode off to transcription service, and then the producer will get a text based with timecode values so that they can go into the edit and cut a picture and build a show. Yes?
How typically are these files moved around? Does the production or the post house provide a place for you to drop all the files into? Are you, at what point does the file leave your care and become somebody else's sort of property or problem? Or how often is it the end of every day you don't go to bed until
That's a great question. The question is, you know, how's this file actually physically get moved around when we're shooting? And I think it's going to be very project dependent. If you're in a feature, if you're doing a, you know, I know this specifically. If you're doing a Robert Zemeckis feature, the insurance company has defined how you manage those files. Because every second that is being recorded represents a huge amount of money. And they say, this is your process, and this has to be vetted, and you're gonna. We need a checksum on everything, and you need to print out the checksum. If it's a small one-person shot, you know, shoot, that's gonna be a whole different process. But, you know, on a typical bigger production, every time you break, there will be the data wrangler. So if you ever see in the scroll, you know, the data wrangler is clearing cards from cameras. So they're taking picture cards, they're taking the sound cards, they're putting it into, you know, they're doing the file transfer, they're oftentimes building a checksum, even in, you know, a typical episodic, just so they verify that they've done a copy. Now, the production recorder, you know, something like this here has an internal drive. You're not going to format that until the project's over. You know, you're typically going to keep all those assets on the machine just in case. For whatever reason, the FedEx truck got hijacked, and you know, with that material. So, you know, fortunately today, file storage is very inexpensive. So we can, you know, in when we're talking about audio, these assets are pretty easy and fast to transfer. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it's just interesting. I mean, is it mostly online where you'll upload the stuff, or like the data wranglers are actually grabbing and copying, or are you sort of responsible for maintaining that until somebody says it's not, you know?
I think.
Lost. Who sort of takes
yeah, I mean that's a conversation oftentimes that happens between, you know, the production and the sound mixer. You know, and oftentimes the sound mixer can say, "How do you want me to deliver this? What is that going to look like?" Production companies like NFL Entertainment, they have their own process. So every stadium in the country has an ingest station. So all the cards from both the sideline sound mixers who are running around and the cameras, there is literally somebody running around all day long clearing cards, doing a transfer, and that goes right back to Pennsylvania. But I think it's going to really depend on, you know, the project and the production. So stereo and surround are important topics that, especially on the deliverable side, but, you know, because specifically with dialogue is mono. So few productions record dialogue in stereo. Anybody ever record stereo dialogue? What was the application? Gotcha. So, yeah, I've heard in DACO applications, oftentimes, especially in Europe, they use MS. Anybody not familiar with MS, raise your hand if you've never heard of MS stereo. Okay, so a couple. But MS stereo, you know, is a great technique because it folds nicely to mono, so you can use the stereo signal as a stereo signal, but it'll fold nicely to mono. So using two microphones for dialogue recording, that's a little non-standard, but I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of different ways to go about it. Yes?
Now, I see on television all the time where at the podium it seems like there's two microphones there. I assume that was like some kind of stereo recording.
When you see White House Communications using, you know, for many years they used two microphones, now they just use the single goose. Those microphones, one is simply a redundant microphone for the other. The odds of an SM57 failing, that's what the microphone is, are pretty low, but you never know, so that's why they have a spare. And that one is often plugged into a separate mixer. White House Communications, since 2004, have used Sound Devices 442s for their mixers. They still use lots of 442 mixers. It's an analog mixer that we make. They've transitioned to some other gear, but yeah, when you see the politician podium, it's simply for redundancy, and oftentimes you'll see two lavs on somebody in a news environment. That is often also for redundancy, typically feeding two separate body pack transmitters. But in the context of dialogue, again, we want that as mono. Again, for some DACO applications, stereo is used. MS stereo is kind of the technique that's often used for that. Sound effects, that runs the gamut. That might be recorded mono, it might be recorded single point stereo, might be recorded with a DECA tree, environmental sounds. Oftentimes, the microphone distances might be hundreds of yards. So if you're hearing an explosion recording, and I've been out to some of these explosion recordings out in the middle of, 4 hours past where your cell phone had reception, at 4 a.m., and you can hear the bugs on the microphone capsules. And subsonic, supersonic rounds, all this stuff, to get that enormous sound field, they are recording with tremendous distances. So, that single point surround microphone, that's not going to get that same kind of sound field. Music is delivered in 5.1. Have you ever seen a gigantic post-mixing console? Some of you have, because there's a few post-mixers. They can reach into just about every single track. They have all the stems available, but they can reach into all the track. But, music's 5.1, dialogue's going to be mono, effects might be mono or stereo. And then, we've seen kind of this, how the cicadas come up every 17 years? Single point stereo is kind of one of those things. Like every 7 years, it seems like we get another single point stereo, renaissance. It was the holophone for a few years, which was a Canadian microphone. Now we've got ambisonic microphones. So we support ambisonic recording in our MixPre 6 and our MixPre 10. It's a very valid technique. In fact, one of the more interesting applications for ambisonics is the ability to kind of, after the fact, make a microphone with a polar pattern that you want that's, kind of whatever polar pattern you want. So, it's all done with math. But as a surround format, it's useful. It's often very useful for, kind of getting a general position and then building a mix around that. So kind of as a scratch placement of, this is kind of where everything sounds. Now let's really build elements and let's really, give ourselves some separation. And our final mix is going to be built from, stems, mono, stereo, surround. It becomes really challenging to decide, like, how am I going to approach this project? What's the deliverable? Speaking of deliverable, Netflix uses, a lot of gear, a lot of sound devices gear. I spent a little time with them. Anybody know what the data rate of the audio that you listen to when you're watching a Netflix show for the 5.1? Anybody take a guess? Oh, if we could only. So the entire 5.1 is in 384 kilobits. So it's quite compressed. We'd love for them to go kind of to the next level. So we have, we'll do a little recording. We've got this tremendous dynamic range and frequency response and resolution, and the final project's got to sit in, a 5.1 mix that fits in 384 kilobits. So networked audio is something that we're seeing show up in a lot of different applications. And what I mean by network audio is tools like Dante. And it is audio riding over an IT platform. So this computer here, this is my MacBook Pro, and I've got an Ethernet connection. And this Ethernet connection goes into the back of the Scorpio here, because the Scorpio has a Dante Dante.io. So with that single Ethernet connection, I can have up to 64 channels bidirectional audio. So if I have a big sound cart, I can have a single cord instead of having a snake with multiple cables. So we're seeing these things that were originally designed for fixed install showing up in production carts, in a mixer that can go over the shoulder. Because we have all these channels, because the channel counts keep going up, it really simplifies the interconnection, especially for multi-track. It takes advantage of all the IT infrastructure. We can route this through, switches that we can buy at the electronics store. We can also take advantage of infrastructure that already exists, like fiber. So if a building's wired for fiber, we can run this cable from here to there and use the fiber infrastructure. So what we're seeing is that it's become valid not just for the fixed install, but it's also being feasible into smaller and smaller I/O. So what we're going to see in the future is more devices that are Dante-enabled and wireless systems with Dante outputs connecting to the mixers over Dante. We have that with our A10 rack. So a sound mixer can put four receivers into a rack-mounted chassis, in a 1U chassis, come out Dante, single connection right into their mixer, and now they've got all their I/O over a single inexpensive Cat5 cable. So we've got gear from Sound Devices, Audio Limited, Aton, Electrosonics, and other. You're starting to see this become more and more common. Now, the advantage is this simple interconnect. The disadvantage is there's a certain amount of routing that's required and a certain amount of knowledge of routing. So this is an app called Dante Control. So what you see here is Scorpio JT. That's my mixer here. And then you see Tutulo's MacBook Pro 15. So what I've routed here, I've taken the output, the audio outs of this MacBook Pro into two channels of the Scorpio. Now, I could take all 32 channels of the Scorpio in and out and use Dante to control all that stuff and essentially use this as an external sound card, for a multi-channel sound card. But I've set this up just for two channels for a demo application here. So Dante is certainly coming to portable gear. Another thing that's coming to portable gear is high dynamic range recording. And what I mean by that is recording techniques that can maximize the dynamic range. Okay, so that's a pretty general statement, John, so what are you really talking about? Microphones are plugged into mixers or preamplifiers. Those preamplifiers are connected to analog to digital converters, and then we record that into a file. So that's our signal chain. And that exists for every manufacturer. We all do the same thing. So let's move back from the file container first. So first, let's talk about a new file format that we're starting to see, and we support that on our MixPre 2 series of recorders. So the MixPre 3, 6, and 10 that are available now offer either 24-bit integer file recording, just like all of our existing devices, but we've also enabled 32-bit float. Now, that's an absurd number, 1,528 dB of dynamic range. Yes, because this is floating point math. So we can shift this around. So dynamic range of the file container is not a limitation. So we've taken that off the equation. Now, 24-bit integer versus 32-bit float, the penalty is about a 30% increase in file size. Fortunately, our hard drive manufacturers are happy to sell us more storage. So if we need to record with very high dynamic range, there is a small penalty, but it's not insurmountable. Another thing that you need moving back from the file container in the signal chain is multiple simultaneous gain stages and A to D converters. So in our latest generation recorders, in the MixPres The Scorpio and the A33 also have this topology. It's not yet activated. But these are multi-stage A to D converting topologies. These are everybody has their own way of doing it. There's a few other manufacturers that approach this. One of the first products that ever came out with multi-stage A to Ds was the Solution D microphone from Neumann. A few years back, it was, you know, fairly specialty high-performance microphone. But this is now a well-known topology and technique, and we have our own special patented way that we do it. And in the mixpres, what it results in is 142 dB of dynamic range. So the mic preamplifier in A to D is essentially no more the limitation of your dynamic range. It becomes the microphone. So now the microphone is the tool that is the gating factor in how much dynamic range we can represent. So I've got this little graph here. What you see here is our signature. Microphone, gain stage, trim, fader, and then storage. And then here is a microphone signal from noise to maximum. 11.3 volts peak to peak? Yes. At the highest amplitudes, it's possible to generate that. Now, if you think about the maximum theoretical dynamic range that can exist, from 0 dB LCP, essentially space, to instantaneous shockwave, instantaneous pressure change. That's about 200 and some dB. So that's the maximum that we could ever generate acoustically. And, you know, our microphones are about 145 dB dynamic range that they can represent. So a 24-bit file can theoretically hold about 144 dB of dynamic range. And with a multi-stage A to D converter, you can actually you can get there. Now, there's no single A to D converter part that has that kind of dynamic range. So you need to use multiple A to Ds in combination in order to get there. So this is the 24-bit world. So in this environment, I've got my signal here, and it can actually fit within that 24-bit file. But here's what happens in the real world. And that is, I might have some gain applied to it, because I need to raise the gain because I want to get this close to 0 dBFS. But if I go over, well, I'm now over 0 dBFS, and at this point, that signal is clipped and it's not recoverable. Well, I've got isotope RX7, and I can recover some of the stuff, and I can work a little bit of recovery, but it's clipped. And then if I really clip it, because I have set a gain structure that I just simply don't know what I have, this is that same file. That's that same signal, but now it's not sitting in a container that can represent it. And likewise, on the other side of it, if I don't have enough gain applied to it, I'm now below the noise floor. So now here's that same environment in the 32-bit float environment. It's the same signal, but now, from the file container standpoint, if I have over-modulated and I'm above 0 dBFS, look where the 0 dBFS point is. It's now at the midpoint of a 32-bit float file. So I'm no longer clipping it. And likewise on the bottom, it's the same. So what this represents is that regardless of where my input trim and gain are, I call it gain invariant. It doesn't really matter because we have multiple gain stages, multiple A to Ds that are taking that signal, constructing it, generating this high dynamic range signal, and recording it to a file container that can accept the entire signal. So let's do a recording here. That. We can minimize this. Let's So I need my glasses because I can't see up close. Who here has the loudest voice? Anybody think they have a really loud, powerful voice? The first hand was the far back. The red hair. Come on up. I need you. All right. So I have set the recorder here to 32-bit float, 48 kilohertz. All right, so here's a recording. I have the gain set. I've got the gain set at 60 dB, which is pretty typical of what I would need for a low-sensitivity dynamic microphone. Now, we're going to start recording.
How loud am I supposed to
get? As loud as you possibly can be. Because I wouldn't do it because I have a microphone on and I would hurt people.
How loud?
Just
loud
get, jump on it.
Go for it. Go.
Well, I actually need speech because okay. we want to be able to hear it. We want to be able to hear what... So yell something really loud.
Something!
Okay, that'll do. All right, so we've recorded a file. Thank you very much. We'll do a little transfer here. I'm going to set this system. File transfer. Okay. Here's the mix pre. Today's 25th. Right, so that's the file. I'm going to put that on the desktop. Come on. Right-click work, please. I hate you, Apple Trackpad. Why can't I drag you? No.
How long am I supposed to go?
Command C?
Yeah, we'll just do that. We'll copy.
Yeah.
We'll go to desktop. We'll paste. All right. So, just to let you know, I'm using this mixer as my sound card. So the computer audio is going through Dante, through virtual sound card, out to the Scorpio. The Scorpio is connected to the PA. So that was mix pre 002, and that was a 32-bit file. So I'm going to open that file. It's on the desktop, mix pre 002. So here's...
Because I wouldn't do it because I have a microphone on.
How loud?
Okay, that clipped pretty good, huh? All right.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
So yell something really loud.
Something.
Okay, that's pretty clipped. All right. So this was recorded as a 32-bit float file because Audition can recognize a 32-bit float file. What I'm actually looking at is only, let's go back to my slides for a moment here. Show back up window. What you're seeing on the screen is just this portion right here. And so we've recorded that file like this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to scale the file because Audition recognizes the file as 32-bit. Let's go back here. Let's reduce the gain. All right, so that was the scream. All right, so that was the other bit there.
Something!
So, it's fully intact. I did an earlier recording with a little bit more of speech. So this is
All right, this is a sample recording of the sound file here. I'm going to clip this thing completely. I am completely clipping this signal.
All right.
I'm going to clip this thing completely. I am completely clipping this signal.
So that is what recording into a 32-bit container, recording with multiple A to D converters allows me to do is take the entire microphone signal and represent that and record it. So what that allows me to do is make gain decisions after I've done my recording. I can now place microphones, I can go and record, and if I don't know what gain structure I should be in, I can make those decisions later if I'm just doing recording. Now, here's a couple things to think about. If I'm outputting this signal and connecting it to a PA or something like that, I still need to consider proper gain structure. So if I'm clipping the signal, I'm going to be clipping the output. Now, interestingly, we feed the headphone app from the 32-bit side. So if you're listening in headphones on the Bixpre, there's no way you're going to be able to clip the signal. So that's something that is kind of cool. You'll, no matter how loud the signal is or how low the signal is, you know, you're listening to the 32-bit feed into the headphone app. Yes?
You mentioned that for recording to a 32-bit container like this, that you need to use multiple A to D converters for this effect to be possible. Mm-hmm. Do you need to use specially built hardware such as that's been designed around that?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so this is not in isolation, just... you know, the gear has to be designed for it. So there's a couple of products that offer this. And, you know, from a kind of where trends are going and where I see things going, I see this being relevant, and I see more devices in the industry showing up like this. I know Sonosax makes a multi-stage A to D recorder and records 32-bit float. I don't think they offer that for sale in the U.S. I think it's only outside the U.S. I know StageTech does multi-stage A to D converters on their pre's. So there's a few devices that are already doing this, but I think we're going to start to see more and more. Now, on the other side of the signal, I want to show you this. And these are two files. And these are sample files that are up on our website. We have a couple tech notes on 32-bit I think are interesting to look at if it's something that's interesting to you. These are dramatically under-recorded signals. And to give you an idea how low these are recorded, let's go to the tech note. Okay, so this is... this is the guitar. Just bear with me just a moment. So this is recorded fader. Okay, so this is well below 100 dBFS. Okay, really low. Okay. First, we're going to hear a 24-bit file. This is a single piano tone being played. Okay, I'll play that again. So you can barely make out that there's some kind of signal that was recorded. This is the 32-bit file at the same gain structure. So I'll raise the gain 15 dB. I'll do the same for this. Actually, maybe I won't. I'll just raise a few. So what that's representing is there's more resolution throughout the entire signal. So back to my graph here. In the 24-bit file, when I'm dramatic, you know, this recording was down to here in the 24-bit file. And at that point, it's unrecoverable. But now in the 32-bit environment, you know, again, we're down here. That's fine, because I still have, you know, a couple 500, you know, dB of dynamic range. I can still take advantage of. So what this represents is, like I said, the ability to connect microphone signals to a recorder, not really care what the gain structure is, hit record, and then be able to scale that gain after the fact. Yes?
What's the sampling rate you use?
That was 48, but I can do up to 192. Yes?
John, I heard in the very soft example that, and maybe this is not what I was hearing, or maybe it was, but when you amplify the very soft level signal in the 32-bit float, that we heard the self-noise of the microphone come up.
Sure.
That what we were hearing?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is still there. We're not reducing the noise. We still have this signal. This is still the original signal, regardless of whether we recorded in a 24-bit environment or a 32-bit environment. So we still have, you know, a noise floor. It still exists. You know, we'll still hear room noise, whatever, all those other elements that, you know, we'll call noise. You know, that will still exist, but what we can do is we can represent that noise more accurately. So we can represent the entire signal more accurately.
So the A to D is 24-bit, and you had to set the gain, the analog gain, so that it didn't clip the A to D.
There's multiple A to D converters. So there's...
How many? Per channel.
That's proprietary.
All right.
I think every manufacturer has different topologies. We do have. You can read our patent if you want to see exactly how we do the crossovers and such. Yes.
I'm sure it will at some point. Maybe the question is how long before it becomes, you know, a small size for like a portable field mixer.
We make one that's a little bit smaller than this. So this. This is the device that we just recorded on, that we yelled into. This is the device that we did the piano recording to.
Okay,
so we're already kind of small. Maybe, I guess we can go smaller, but, you know, we're constrained by, you know, batteries and those pesky XLR connectors. Any other questions on 32-bit? Yes. I think because we're talking about such a big scale, I think within the kind of that center point, we have a tremendous amount of resolution.
I imagine if you recorded it really, really, really low,
well,
that would be a problem.
You know, again, back to, you know, this is all cool to look at, you know, how much dynamic range we have, but we still need to set up proper gain structure, because if I'm outputting out of here, you know, this is going to output a, you know, let's say I'm interconnecting over Dante. Well, Dante is 24-bit fixed. So AES-3 is 24-bit fixed. So, you know, that's the world that we're still interfacing with, and so we still have to recognize gain structure, and I still can't go above 0 dBFS for that. So what we can do here at the point of recording from a microphone source, now, a wireless, we can't do that because I've got a gain structure between this microphone and this transmitter. That's one analog gain structure. I got another gain structure between the receiver and the input here, because again, this is analog. We still have to recognize that we're still interconnecting in a 24-bit world, and you know, with, you know, analog I/O, and we can't scale that. But for special applications, for when I'm able to record with microphone sources, you know, this is a big advantage. Yes?
32-bit float is just a production format. There's no consumer. You wouldn't download a movie in 32-bit. That's not a playback.
Well, you know, the funny thing is we talked a little bit about dynamic range. We talked about speech recording. When we go to a, you know, superb performance venue that has incredibly low noise, and we listen to a, you know, a concert, acoustical concert, we might have a total dynamic range in that environment from, let's say, a noise floor of 35 dB LCP to, you know, 110 dB maximum. So maybe 70 dB of dynamic range is what, you know, the real world actually is. If I go to a rock and roll show, it might be a 10 dB of dynamic range. You know, if I'm watching a movie, that dialogue's probably within a range. It's been compressed so hard by the time you see it, you know, it's probably within a 5 dB dynamic range. You know, the programs that we end up, the deliverable at the very end result is often very different than what's recorded. But what we have now is the ability to get everything we can at the point of recording, and then we can make some of those decisions later on. Because what we would need to do in this context in a 24-bit world here is, that's a little egregious, but here is, I would apply a limiter. So I would limit this signal so that, you know, as it approaches 0 dBFS, it's reducing the dynamic range of the signal. So that's not representing the original signal. So if I want to be able to represent the original signal, I'll do one of two things. One is I'll set my gains correctly in a 24-bit environment, or I can use 32-bit float and kind of make those decisions after the fact. So any questions on production sound? Any questions on anything? Sound devices, gear? Please, yes.
I bought your 702 primarily for the microphone preamps.
Okay.
I didn't even think that I wanted a portable recorder, but I have decided that I didn't like the portable aspect of it. But I was noticing, like, if a lot of people use your products with wireless microphones, it's kind of like they don't get to take advantage of the nice preamps. Do you make wireless mic preamps, or does it just not matter that it's two different worlds?
Well, we acquired Audio Limited a few years ago, so we recognize that that is an important part of the signal chain. So the A10 circuit that's in there was designed by Matt Anderson, who designs our preamps, my business partner. So the A10 has a superb mic preamplifier. It is limited by power consumption. It's also limited by, you know, the sensitivity of a lavalier microphone, which, you know, compared to a much larger diaphragm condenser mic with a much bigger power supply, is going to perform differently. But we recognize that, and, you know, that's one of the advantages of digital is, you know, once that microphone's converted digital, we can maintain that all the way through the signal chain. Any other questions? You've been a great audience. I've got a couple of toys up here. I've got our Scorpio. This is, like I mentioned, our production mixer we introduced earlier this year. This is kind of the superset of all of our products. It's got 16 microphone preamplifiers. It's an internal 256 gig SSD. It records 36 tracks, so there's 32 channels, plus the left-right mix, plus a couple of aux buses. And one of the things we architecturally did with Scorpio that's very similar to a lot of digital consoles is there's a tremendous amount of bus flexibility. There's 10 buses, and you can send signals to a bus pre-fade, post-fade, or a specific level. So you can build multiple mixes, and where this becomes relevant is in productions where you've got a lot of comm. And, you know, you're feeding the script supervisor one signal, the director wants to hear it one way, or especially in these, you know, bigger shows where there's lots of comm channels, you know, some of these big productions, there might be, 30 audio channels, there might be 60 tracks of comm. Comm becomes its own world and gets very complex very quickly, but you can now integrate all that in your production mixer, so it's quite powerful. We introduced a few weeks ago, a little brother to it, the A33. So this uses the same architecture as Scorpio. The A33 will essentially replace our 633, which is a very popular production mixer. So in this little chassis here, you've got six preamplifiers. You also have an internal 256 gig SSD, plus two SD cards, timecode reader. Runs off of either L-mount batteries or external DC. So, really a very capable production mixer. And like I said, from the preamp architecture, these are our highest performance preamplifiers in the A33 and in the Scorpio. And the topology that we have in our little mix pre, the multi-stage A to D, the hardware is implemented in the A33. It's not yet active. So these at present record 24-bit. And for production, that is still the gold standard. That's what everybody's using. We will see as time goes on, with these little mix pre's. These have recently been revved. We introduced these about 2 years ago, the mix pre 3, 6, and 10. And then we came out with, fairly recently, about a month and a half ago, a new revision of it, the Mixpre 2s. So this has this new architecture, the multi-stage A to Ds. These also all have timecode generators. So these are a nice piece for somebody who wants a full professional tool, no compromise in audio, but doesn't need all the specific tools, busing, routing, that some of our bigger mixers have. So these are popular, and these are much more cost effective. So these come in at pricing. This is about $850, $899, something like that. There's a 3 that's $649, and then the 10 is $1,400, $1,399, something like that. So this is we've revised many of our products, and these are kind of the sweet spot of a lot of bang for the buck. So that's my presentation for the evening. I greatly appreciate your attention, and this has been my pleasure.